World War II. It's known as the Greatest Generation. And these are their stories. It's the World War II Project. Here are your hosts, Americhicks Molly Vogt and Kim Munson.
Welcome to the Americhicks World War II Project with Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. This show precipitated from a trip that we took to Normandy in 2016 with a team that took four D-Day veterans back to Normandy. And Molly, it truly changed our lives.
Absolutely did. What was so amazing for me, actually, well, standing there in Normandy and hearing the stories of the veterans themselves, but also just seeing the way that the community treated our veterans. There are American flags flying all over Normandy. There are, you know, in the schools, the kids have American flags and pictures of our presidents as well. And it's just so interesting how everybody there remembers, because they tell the stories of what happened in the great sacrifice that our World War II veterans made for them. And we want to make sure that people understand that in the future going forward. History books are history books, but there's nothing like listening to the personal story of someone who is actually there.
Well, that's for sure. So we came back and we said we must tell these stories. So we've had the great honor to interview over 100 different veterans. You can find those stories on podcasts. Americhicks, or our website, Americhicks.com. Mm-hmm. So we do have on the line with us World War II veteran Dave DiMicci, and he served in the Pacific Theater. So, Dave, welcome to the Americhicks World War II Project.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Dave. Do you mind, just let's start out talking about the branch and the unit that you were a part of in World War II.
Well, I enlisted in November of 42. And I was with the 7th Air Force, 30th Bomb Group and 38th Bomb Squadron flying out of Saipan. Missions were over Iwo Jima.
Great. And how did you decide to enlist, Dave?
Well, I had a football scholarship, and after football season, about 10 of us decided they had a program called ERC, Enlisted Reserve Corps, which meant that we would go to officers training, and that folded, and so we didn't go there. And I think that was the best thing that happened to me, not being trained in the infantry. So, eventually I got there was something out of bulletin board in the chow hall. That said they needed radio operators and gunners in the Air Corps. So I answered the thing and went to Sioux Falls, South Dakota for radio school, and then to Yuma, Arizona for gunnery school.
All right.
And you want me to go on what happened after that?
Yes, sir, please do.
Yeah, well, so after gunnery school, a lot of the people assembled in California, and we were assigned to a crew, a 10-man crew, and the pilot was Jim Reeks, and we had four officers and six enlisted men, and I was a radio operator, and we had a flight engineer and four gunners. And we also fired I fired the right waist gun on a B-24, and the engineer fired the left waist gun on a B-24. And then we had a tail gunner had double 50s, a top turret gunner had double 50s, a belly gunner had double 50s, and a nose gunner had double 50s. So in all, we had 50 caliber machine guns on every 10-inch plane.
Wow. That's a lot of power.
Yeah, I guess.
Now, where did you grow up, Dave?
Where did I what?
Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born. My dad and mom, they weren't married, but they came over from Tirol, Austria. And in those days, you know, they talk about all these people. Oh, yeah, all these people crossing the border. Oh, they want to come and work. You know, my dad had to have a job and a sponsor before he could get into this country. So he had a cousin that was a coal miner in Ohio. He came in, and my mother came over as a housekeeper, and they met and got married. We lived in, and my dad went to get out of the coal mining, and went to Milwaukee and was a digging storm sewers, and he, there was an accident. He lost half of his foot. So we, and Wisconsin was the first state that had workman's comp. We got $60 a month for nine of us, and of course we couldn't make it, so we moved out to a small 10-acre farm until I had two older sisters and two older brothers, and they had to go to school until they were 16. When they were over 16, they went to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And then when all of them were working, they could afford it. And then we moved to Milwaukee, and I spent, I guess maybe I was 10 years old until high school. I was, played football, and I was captain of my high school football team in Milwaukee, Milwaukee North, a large high school, and which was quite an honor, and I didn't think I deserved it, but oh. I guess they had no one around that was that dumb to take the job. So I don't know.
So you took the job, okay.
So I was recruited by Whitewater State Teachers College and had a full scholarship there.
Nice.
So your other siblings, did anybody else serve in World War II?
Yes, my brother Joseph, he was my oldest brother. He served, he was a medic in Europe, and he was in the Battle of the Bulge, and he survived okay. But I think when I look at him now, he changed so much. And I think because of the horrors, you know, of war, and he had to take care of all these soldiers that most of them, he said, passed away because they were injured so badly.
Yeah.
And I always thought, boy, if we would have had helicopters in those days, we would have saved a lot of lives.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can see now, these people that are in service now, they surviving, legs blown off, but there they just died.
Right. Now, hey, Dave, explain a little bit to people that may not know what a medic did exactly, particularly in Battle of the Bulge, which that's what your brother did.
I didn't hear the question, except the Battle of the Bulge.
Yeah. What does a medic do? What is their responsibilities on the battlefield?
I wasn't in Europe.
Right. But what did your brother tell you? What did your brother say that his responsibility was?
He didn't say much. He was very quiet. And of course, he lives in Milwaukee, and I lived in Whitewater, and then, you know, I couldn't see him much as a veteran because I was in college when he was at home, you know, and then I went in the service, and he was already in the service, but. But my brothers, I had two brothers, both of them older than me, and I was so surprised when I visited him one time. He pulled out a pearl handled pistol with my picture in it, and we never, you know, in a big family like that, we weren't like buddies, you know what I mean?
Okay, got it.
Fought for everything we had. We used to fight all the time. I was the baby, but they learned me how to protect myself.
Right.
that's good. So you were the captain of your football team. 10 of you guys decide that you're going to go down and enlist.
You have to talk a little slower, dear.
Okay. So Dave DiMicci, you were the captain of your football team. And yes. You and 10 of the other guys decided to join the military. Do you know what happened to any of the other guys that joined with you?
Well, my roommate, you know, I was told it's probably the smallest linebacker in the world. I weighed 156 pounds. But my roommate was 6'4 and 240.
Wow.
And I can't remember if any of them that of us got killed. But he got a Silver Star, and when I asked him how he got it, he just swore at me. He said, "I didn't do nothing. Shut your effing mouth." That was the end. That was the end of World War II discussions for about 50 years for me.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, Dave, we sure are glad that you're talking about it now. We know that the things that you did, that you saw, you sacrificed and lost, there's a lot that those of us who weren't there will never totally understand. And so that's why we're so thankful that you're sharing the stories. You sure saw a lot of horrors, but you guys fought tyranny.
Yeah, I give speeches every once in a while. I spoke at the Eisenhower Center in Gettysburg. I lived there in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And I also spoke at the high school there. Very disappointed. People didn't know anything about World War II. The third time I spoke, it was better because the instructor, Dad, was in the service, so he was able to ask questions and some of the kids, and they were a lot better than the first two groups I spoke to. Mm. But they don't have history anymore. I mean, I don't know what we can do, but
That is one of the things that we are doing with these World War II shows, is to get these stories so that we have them for future generations. Because you're absolutely correct, Dave DiMicci. It's a real head scratcher why we are not teaching our kids about World War II. What did you tell the kids when you went to the school? What did you tell them about your experiences in World War II?
Well, they were more interested in what I was doing outside of World War II. The word got around that I was quite a dancer. I had a very wonderful partner after my wife died. We just were dance partners. And they asked me what I did. I just said, teach us how to dance. They didn't want to hear anything about the war.
Oh, my God.
What kind of dancing did you like?
We do ballroom dancing, jitterbugs, mostly jitterbugs and cha-cha and rumba and waltz.
Nice. What was your favorite music that you were listening to in the 40s?
Well, the big band music, Frank Sinatra and all the big bands that you don't hear anymore.
Yeah. Do you remember the band that Frank Sinatra played when he was a young boy?
Well, when I was a young boy, we didn't even have a radio. That was in the 30s, you know. It was a tough time spending trying to make a living. In fact, when I was about 12 years old, I sold timber in Milwaukee on the corner of 12th and Brown and got a Milwaukee Journal for 3 cents. I made a penny of paper, and on Sunday, we sold the Sunday paper for 10 cents, and I made 2 cents. So I was really wealthy.
That's for sure. And people, you learned how to work, and I think that's really, really important.
We all had to work to survive. I mean, we didn't have the county. I mean, nobody gave us any money. Well, once in a while we could go down. We called it the Pogey, and we lived on 11th Street in Milwaukee. We'd go down to 12th Street, and sometimes we'd get butter and flour, just basic stuff. And my mother was a very good cook, and so we ate pretty good.
So, Dave DiMicci, just since I asked you that question, I had to pull it up because we had a World War II veteran before tell us how much they loved listening to Frank Sinatra.
I can go slower, please.
Back here. Okay. The Frank Sinatra's first band, I just wanted to let you know, in 1935 was the Three Flashes.
Oh.
And then it became the Hoboken Four.
No, well, so, I don't know too much about that. That was when I started 1935. I was 11 years old then, so
Dave,
I wasn't allowed to waste my time listening to music.
Right.
I was playing football or baseball or doing something other than working at a newspaper.
Yeah. Well, Dave, let's talk about, do you remember where you were when you heard that Pearl Harbor was bombed?
Where I was where? When?
When you heard that Pearl Harbor had been bombed by the Japanese?
I was in my folks' home. I was 17 at the time, and it was a Sunday. Yeah, it was a Sunday, December 7th. And my dad, we had a radio that we couldn't touch. My dad would he would zero in the stations, you know. And that's when I heard that and I didn't know where Hawaii was. I really didn't care. Where Hawaii? What business? They're not next door to me. So, but I did. When the war started, the funeral director and I had would go around and make sure everybody had their lights off in Milwaukee. We had a couple, one block that tore every night, you know, to make sure that you couldn't see any lights in the house, which was, I think was kind of stupid, but I guess that we did it. So,
what happened if somebody had their lights on? Did you just knock on the door and tell them to shut them off?
Yeah, we never had to do that because they all were frightened, I guess, that they were going to get bombs dropped on them in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, you know, and blast all the breweries. So that would have been terrible.
It would have been very strategic, huh?
All right. So, Dave Domenici, you served, you were at Iwo Jima in the Pacific. Let's talk about what was your training? You said that you did your training. You were a radio operator, and you also did gunner school as well. What day did you leave America, and how did you get over to the Pacific?
Well, after we were assigned to a crew, we went to Muroc Army Air Base in California, which is now a part of Edwards, I think. It's in a desert, and that was worse than combat.
Hmm. How so?
On August 1st, 1944, we were going on a mission to train the bombardier to drop 20 bombs, and we lost an engine, so we had three engines and came in for an emergency landing, and there was a miss. Something went wrong with the pilot and the tower. The tower said, "Make a roll around. We have an emergency landing." And my pilot thought he was talking to somebody else. So we made a real go around and then the downwind leg. When we took off all the time, I would have to sign into the net and into the radio with a Morse code, you know. And then when I down my leg, I was just bending over to turn my transmitter off, and the plane lurched and smashed into the ground, and if we lost another engine, in other words, we were on, instead of three, we were on two. Three was okay; we could fly on three, but two, and when the second one went out. That's when we couldn't fly anymore. We just hit the ground. We belly flopped in there, but heck, we were bound with fire and sand. And I can remember, just as an aside, my bombardier was a cocky little big guy. His name was Steve Pittis, and he always told me, "Davey, so you better be a good football player, but if we ever crash, get out of my way." Well, upon landing, the pilot, the engineer, the navigator came out from the nose section, and they braced themselves against, you know, one landing. Now, landing on a B-24 was kind of rough, you know.
Yeah.
But they would brace themselves on the pilot's seat in the cobble. And when we hit, I couldn't see anything, and I was pinned up against the throttles of the airplane, and I couldn't get up because we hit the ground at about 140 miles an hour, you know, and I'm pinned to the ground, and I'm trying to come up and get up and trying to get up, and I finally got up, and I knew where there was an escape hatch, and I knocked both the diving gear and a bombardier down, and I got to the... I knew it was, you know, smoke and fire and everything. So I got to the little, there was a little ladder behind the pilot, and there was a hatch above on the top of the plane, and I found it in the dark, and I opened it and climbed out, and I'm standing there looking down at this place, and I said, "What the heck am I doing here?" And the co-pilot comes. Yeah, I remember he had his sunglasses in his hand. His name was Lou Dennis, and he started to run across. He jumped off the plane, the body of the plane, and I hollered at him. He did terribly. He just kept running, and I said, "What am I doing here?" So we eventually all got out. We eventually all got out except the pilot, and we were just, you know, congratulated and tell stories how we got out, whether the tail gunner ran into the side of the airplane before it stopped, and the top turret gunner got hooked up on a machine rack, and I mean, where I had my 50 caliber, and my nose gunner, who was my best friend, he kind of flight and everybody down and got, we all got out except the pilot. And you wonder, what was going to happen to Jim? And pretty soon we saw him come out and his hair was smoking. So we started, we were just there. I don't know, it seemed like a long time, but it wasn't. Then we had 50 caliber ammunition on the plane, which we were going to, sometimes we just, they would have a tow target, and we practiced shooting at the tow target. That would never have been the family carrying the tow target. But anyway, because it was live ammunition, we were shooting at a tow target. You know. But the ammunition, because of the heat, started to cook off. In other words, it started a fire. It started to go bad, and then we took off across the desert. The fire truck started to come out, and we waved them off. And as soon as they turned, the plane blew up. There was much left of it.
Wow! I'm glad you guys got out of there.
That was only the first. Well, the first night flight. Is okay. Am I doing okay?
Hey, you're doing. You know what? Let's hold that thought. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back, and we want to hear about that night flight. This is the AmeriChicks. Molly Vogt and Kim Munson with our World War II project. We are talking with World War II veteran Dave DiMicci. We'll be right back.
Hey, welcome back to the AmeriChicks World War II project. Check out our website, AmeriChicks.com, for all of our former shows. And if you have a World War II veteran who'd like to share their story, we would love to get it and record it for future generations. We're on the phone with Dave DiMicci. He served in the Pacific Theater. He's going to tell us about Iwo Jima here soon. He was in the Army Air Corps, joined in November 1942. Dave, please remind me which unit you were a part of.
Well, I was with the 7th Air Force, 30th Bomb Group, 38th Bomb Squadron. There's four 12-plane squadrons in each group.
Okay.
So we had 48 planes on Saipan.
Okay, great. All right. So before we went to break, Dave, you were telling us you had some serious risks. You were taking place during training in California before you even made it over to the Pacific Theater. Your plane basically blew up. Tell us about the next training mission.
Okay. It was our first night flight, and we took off, and I was sitting at my radio, and I had a small window, and I was looking right over number three engine, and I saw this liquid pouring off of the wing. So I called my engineer and I said, "Hey, Pep, is it raining?" He said, he kind of swore at me. He said, "We're in the desert. It never rains in here." What's it? I said, "Look at this." And it was gasoline pouring out of engine number three.
Oh no!
Each engine had its own tank in each engine, and number three was. When we came back from a practice mission, we had to fill the gasoline tank, okay? And each engine had a total of 2,700 gallons of gas in. And when we finished filling it up, we had to put the cover on it, and then we had to wire the cap down. Otherwise, somebody did not wire the cap down, so when the vibration of the airplane threw the cap off, and that's what caused the engine to leak. So we had, there we go. We had to get another emergency landing. And in fact, we had 19 times that we couldn't take either had to go back or couldn't take the plane off because it was in such poor shape in 6 months of training. So anyway. So the pilot so we went into the land. He fed, when you say I feathered the prop, the props are turned so that there's no drag on the prop on them. Well, anyway, so we're going down, and all of a sudden the plane started to go to the right down the runway, and I found out later that we had a runaway prop governor on number three engine. Okay, so we could land. So he says, and we were landed. I always stand between the pilot and co-pilot, standing or watching what's going on. So anyway, he says to the co-pilot, "Wheels up and flaps up." Well, there isn't enough hydraulic pressure to put both of those at the same time. So we're going down the runway sideways, kind of. And I'm looking out the window there. And all these lights, and all of a sudden I see a big flash. And the pilot said, "Take." We just had the wheels up. So then we started to climb. The tower calls us and said we've had a temporary power failure, and just circle the field. We'll have it fixed. Well, we circled for 3 hours. You know what we did? We hit a tie tension wire with our wheels.
Oh, my gosh.
And if we would have been about a foot lower, we would hit the airplane, and the gasoline all over the floor and the bits. So that was the second time that we escaped death.
Wow. Yes, absolutely, Dave DiMicci, World War II veteran. Go on.
The third time we had a guy was going to check my pilot out of instrument flying, and he just finished 35 missions. He was flying co-pilot. So we were in a big formation, so he tells the pilot, pokes him on the shoulder, he points, go closer, get in closer. And we always through close formation. In other words, all our guns would be located, in a big bunch of airplanes. So the pilot turned. He wanted to go and get closer, which meant he had to turn. He had to go to the right. When he took the wheel and turned to the right, nothing happened. The plane was going straight.
Oh my gosh.
He could. They're going straight, and the guy back from combat. He says, "Let me take that." He's jerking the wheel to make it go right there. But we just went straight. Well, the worst thing about that is if you are caught behind the prop watch of a plane in front of you, the airplane goes to the left. I mean, it looks like it's going to dive to the left. We couldn't go to the right, so we'd have been done. But fortunately, we were going right towards the airfield, and we landed. And they found that there was most of the controls were done by cable, except the flaps and the wheels. They were hydraulic, and the lower ball was hydraulic, but they found a wrench in the cables.
No.
And they had, the guys had their names on the wrench. And this guy said he's going to go back and kill that guy.
Oh, man. So, Dave DiMicci, I can't imagine.
That was number three.
By the time you got into actual war, you probably weren't afraid of anything.
Because, yeah, I kept the airplane.
Well, the B-24, I read about the B-24, and they said because they were building so many at a time, and they were different plants.
One every 59 minutes in the Ford plant in Michigan.
Wow.
Right.
It's going to take 60 minutes.
Oh, man. So, all right. Well, do you have another training story, or do you want to take us to the Pacific?
Let's see. No, I think the last one was after we completed our last. Well, the next one happened in combat, actually.
Okay.
So let's go to that. So what happened in combat?
And where are you?
Dave DiMicci, where are you?
Yeah, we're on Saipan. We took off 12 planes. We're going up to, we had already been up to Iwo Jima a couple of times. And this one, they sent us out to bomb Chichi Jima. Now, Chichi Jima, I don't know if you've ever saw the first President Bush, the first one. He was the youngest pilot. He was 18 years old. He flew a bomber, a three-man crew, and they bombed Chichi Jima, and they got shot down. And fortunately, there was a ship. A ship that goes underwater.
A submarine.
submarine, yeah. And it show, and it was on TV. It shows him boarding the submarine. They picked him up,
right.
But his two crewmen got killed when it crashed in the water. So we were out. We took off, and taking off from Saipan was a thrill because we had to go in the lowlands of the mountains there. And if I looked out my window, I saw the planes that didn't make it because we were really loaded.
Gosh.
We had 9,500 pound incendiaries aboard, and we had 2,700 gallons of gas in the wing tanks, and we had an auxiliary 500 gallon tank in the right bomb bay. So we had a total of 3,200 gallons of gas and 9,500 pumps, plus all the other equipment that we had.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't contain it. So we were going to Chichijima. I don't know what. I think they're trying to get even with us. I don't know. But anyway, so we got out about. It was out about an hour, and my engineer came in. He came up to the flight deck, and he said, "Dave, we got a gas leak." I said, "Oh, we always got a gas leak. What's the matter?"
What's new?
Yeah. He says, "No, Dave, we got a gas leak." So I called out, but I looked up, and one of the wing cells collapsed, and gasoline was pouring on these 9,500-pound incendiary bombs like you had a shower of gasoline on them.
Oh, my gosh.
So I went up and grabbed the coal pipe, and I said, Hey, look, we got to get, we always got strapping on all kinds of gas. And I said, "Hey, come on." I grabbed him by the shoulder, and he went to the pilot. He said, we got to go back. And it's really bad. So the pilot makes a turnaround, and I went around and told, don't use the intercom because of the static electricity could set us off. the big boom. And then the pilot decided that we couldn't drop the bombs because on the B-24, the bomb bay opened up metal on metal. It wasn't the kind that you see on the B-17s where the bomb flip open. This was metal on metal. So he's deciding if I try to go metal on metal, the static electricity could blow us up because he was all out of
it.
So he decided to land. And so he said to me, "Dave, go and signal the tower." I was rigged. I also had an Alden lamp where I could do Maris code with light, with a light, like a flashlight or whatever. Like. So I went back there, and I was going to plug. I wasn't going to plug it in because it was gas. In fact, the gas leak was so high, it covered up the plug that was supposed to plug.
Oh, my gosh, Dave.
So I waited a couple of minutes. I went up. I said, "Hey, Jim," our pilot. I said, "Jim, we got the green light." He said, "I didn't see any green light." I said, "They don't keep it on all day." I said, "We got the green light. We can land." So he decided to land, and our landing speed was like 140 miles an hour, but we had a heavy load on there, you know.
Yeah.
So we came in to land, and bounced once. The second time it bounced, the right tire blew up.
Oh, my God.
I don't know if you've ever been in a car if you have a tire blow on, but the plane just did a ground loop right over, and I was right standing between the pilot and the co-pilot. And we're headed, I could see a whole row of B-24s. We were heading right at it.
Oh, my gosh.
So the pilot did a hell of a job. He jumped on the left brake and in two full power to the right two engines and swung it around. And he tried to just steer it. He wanted to get the plane off of the runway because it was all gas, you know. So he tried to do it a little bit again, but he got it to straight, we went right off the end of the runway. Into a grass area, and we all jumped out of the airplane, you know, and he was so excited, he jumped off the leading edge and went, almost broke his legs. And so we went and hunted, and some guy in a motorcycle comes up and said, "What are you guys having a problem?" I said, "You," and I swore again. I said, "You see that? That's not water coming out of that airplane. It's gasoline. Oh, we got to get the hell out of here."
Oh, my gosh. I cannot imagine coming back and landing that with full of gasoline as well as bombs. You know, we think we have rough landings sometimes. We were coming into Denver. I think that I'm going to thank my lucky stars.
Did you get to sleep at least a good 8 hours after that one, Dave?
What's that?
Did you get to sleep at least an entire 8 hour night after that?
Let me tell you, when we would come back from a mission, we'd go to an interrogation. Then we'd go to the medics, and we would hold our pint canteen cup up, and they would pour 100 proof of rye in it. And you slug that down and staggered back to your tent and didn't have a mattress, just you know, canvas and no pillow. We just plopped on there. Then we got 10 hours sleep then.
Wow.
But that was really could have been we'd have ruined a whole bunch of airplanes besides ourselves.
that's for sure. Well, Dave. Dave. Why don't we go to break? Because you had mentioned that you had flown to Iwo Jima a couple of times. Let's talk about Iwo Jima because it was such an important battle because we needed the airfields there. So let's go to break. And when we come back, let's talk about that experience.
Real quick, I want to give a shout out to Hooters. It is football season. It's time to tackle Hooters restaurants, great football specials. The Americhicks love them. Tell them you know the Americhicks. The specials at Hooters start at $10 for a draft, 10 boneless wings, and $15 for Big Daddy and sliders or bone-in wings. The traditional are our new favorite, the smoked wings. Love, 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 love them. And they're half the calories, so, you know, have as many as you want. Got a group to feed? Try Hooters restaurants, pitcher and nachos for only $20. What are you waiting for? Get your game on and get into Hooters. Check out HootersColorado.com. That's HootersColorado.com. Tell them the Americhicks sent you. Hey, welcome back to the Americhicks World War II Project with Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. We are on the line with Dave DiMicci. He served as a radio operator in World War II in the Pacific Theater, and he's been telling us some amazing stories of bravery and courage and
that was just in training.
Almost some catastrophes from training. But Dave, you said that you did fly over Iwo Jima a few times.
Yes.
I'm curious, what was your mission and what were you visually seeing there?
Okay. Our first mission over Iwo Jima, our 30th bomb group bombed Iwo Jima 70 days in a row before the invasion. Mm-hmm. Because Iwo Jima had three airfields, and everybody was as scared of kamikaze planes. You know, when we invaded an island, we always had a lot of battle wagons and aircraft carriers, and they were afraid. We bombed our group, 12 planes at a time, would go up to Iwo Jima and drop bombs, try to hit the airfields. But we very rarely saw anything because they were dug in and all. But the first time we were up was very, very exciting. They always told us, at first, when we first went out, Iwo Jima didn't have radar for their AT-AT guns, anti-aircraft guns. So they would have an airplane. We usually bombed it around 21,000, and they had an airplane circling above us. And he would radio down to them our position, and you know we always did evasive action when we got close to our target. The lead bombardier had control of the airplane, not altitude, but he would go back and forth try to evade the attack, you know, and so they always told us now look up into the sun because that's where that guy's going to come down and he will drop a phosphorus bomb in the middle of the formation. Now, if phosphorus got caught in your cowling of your engine, it would burn your engine out and you would have to drop out and then they would come after you. Okay. So we started getting dressed for 50 below zero weather. It took us about an hour to put our underwear on, our booties on, and our coveralls, and our pack-a-line suit, and all. And we had a black vest, and we had a harness. I don't know why they gave us a harness, a parachute harness. We jumped in the water, and the sharks, and you just, well, anyway. And also, we had a May West, too, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
And those Mae West explain is one of those little rafts, so that if you ended up in the water, it was a little raft that you could be in, right?
Yeah, it was. You know, it was just. You talking about Mae West?
Yeah.
That was the only thing I have on regular airplanes. You know, only ours was a little better, probably. But no, if you had a ditched airplane, a B-24, it would crack in half because of the twin stabilizers we had. When you go in the water, you come down tail first. So the B-24, because it had a twin tail, we had 95% casualties of a 10-man crew on the ditching of a B-24.
Wow.
So that was not very good. So
no,
anyway,
it's not.
So anyway, that day, the day before, we always went and loaded our bombs and ammunition and checked our radios and my waist gun, I'd have to open the window and put my gun out, you know, and it was 50 below zero. But also we had three pairs of gloves. We had silk gloves, wool gloves, and electrically heated gloves. The silk gloves were in case you had a jam on your 50 caliber, you couldn't touch metal with bare hands. That's what the silk gloves were, the brown silk gloves, okay? That never happened to me. But also on my gun, I had a mic switch on it. Otherwise, you always had a mic switch that you just carried in your hand. I checked it, and it didn't work. My mic switch on my gun didn't work. So anyway, I'm there looking up into the sun. All of a sudden, I see these white streamers coming down. The guy dropped a phosphorus bomb, and he was hanging right in front of me. I could see two red meatballs. I felt like I'd go out and hit him with my fist. But my first job was to call out the position. 3 o'clock high, but my mic switch wouldn't work, so I had to grab one that was hanging out. And by that time, I think the top turret gunner got a shot at him. But I know I could have killed him. I mean, but they say, you've got to call the position so all the guns can go out. Well, anyway, so that was my first. So anyway, then I remembered my next job. As soon as I heard bombs away, I would have to leave my post and go maybe, I don't know, maybe 6 feet. And there was a valve that I would have to. Our ball gunner, the ball on a B-24 was retractable, and it was when I heard bombs away, I'd have to go over and crack the valve and lower the lower ball, put it down, you know. And so I busted everything loose, and I had oxygen, and I struggled back and I saw that airplane going down to land, and I emptied my machine gun out of it. I was so excited. So they say, "Hey, Dave, did you get him?" I said, "No, I think I hit the ocean." So anyway.
Got a couple fish.
It wasn't funny. Yeah, I killed some fish. Well, then we had two other, which were uneventful. Oh, but then the Japanese guy got radar. Or I guess it was, yeah. So they could track us better. And then the one time we went up there with 12 planes, 9 of them got in. None of them went down. But we didn't get hit. But you could feel, when you got close to ACAC, you could feel like you still had your head in a barrel and somebody was whacking it with a rubber hose. That's the way it sounded. You could almost feel the concussion. It was close, you know.
Hmm.
But then the last mission to Iwo Jima was February 19th, 1945. That was D-Day when the Marines landed and started the war. Well, on that mission, 12 of the airplanes went up. There were two reasons they told us. One was to draw fire from the Japanese who were on the island, and the other one was to drop bombs on the beach, hoping to make holes in the sands of the Marines. There was nothing there. It was just, there was no trees. There were so when we went down, I happened to be. We always flew like in a one plane in a diamond. You know, three planes in a diamond, like three on the left on the lead, and three on the left, three on the tail, and three on the right. We happened to be. Our plane happened to be under. I happened to be the closest to what was going on, and I could look out my window, and how long was it? Maybe a half a second or maybe a second, and I could see the Marines heading for the shore.
Oh, my gosh. What went through your mind then, Dave DiMicci?
Oh, my. And then also, we started to climb. We went over. There was battle wagons lined up and aircraft carriers, and I just happened to see, when we were going up, one of the Japanese opened fire on us and shot up. It didn't hit us, but the battle wagon fired a 16-inch gun, and the recoil from the gun moved the battle wagon back in the water.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. If you ever shot a shotgun, you get bang, you get your shoulders bumped up. And then we climbed in, and we went home. But that was it. And those poor guys, those poor Marines, my best friend got killed on Okinawa.
Mm.
My high school buddy.
Oh, Dave, I'm sorry.
Was
Iwo Jima your last mission then? You were not involved in Okinawa?
I didn't hear you then.
Okay. Was Iwo Jima your last mission, or were
yeah,
you?
Yeah, that was the last combat mission. Okay. And then we went back to a Wheeler Field in Hawaii, in Oahu, and we were training to go to Okinawa and bomb Japan from Okinawa. We didn't have enough gas to go. That's when the B-29s came in, and they were flying out of Saipan and Tinian and Bob. But we were there training, and oh my, that was some. My pilot had an eye infection, and he had to go back to the States, and we got a pilot. Said Jay Musler. Wow, what a guy. If you say, Jay, you can fly 24 hours a day. He said, you really mean that, Dave? I said, yeah. I said, they'll let you. He loved flying more than eating.
Huh.
This guy started out as a pilot in, he joined the Canadian Air Force, and he flew twin-engine bullfighters in the African campaign. And then he joined the RAF, and he flew the big bomber there, and then he became a fighter pilot. He flew the Spitfire and the, I can't think of it right now. Whoa. Well, anyway, there was two fighter pilots. And then he was drafted. He had to come back to the United States, and he became our pilot. Well, he thought he was still flying a fighter plane. The guy would, we would take off. And we were supposed to make 20 runs to the pot, so the bombardier was supposed to bomb some rock, and he would say, salvo the whole damn thing. We'd drop all 20 bombs on this rock sticking out in the water someplace. And so he'd take us up and let us fly the plane, and he'd screw around.
They probably wouldn't look very kindly on somebody doing that today, would they, Dave?
I didn't understand okay. that.
I said they probably would not look kindly on someone doing that today.
Oh, no, they wouldn't have known it then, too, because when we take off, he'd buzz everything in sight. Cows running out there. He'd buzz transport ships. and we'd love the guy. He just loved to fly. So one time we got a brand-new B-24M, and that plane, instead of having as a waste gunner, the guns were mounted in plexiglass, so we didn't have to stand in 50 below zero weather. It was cold, but and they never told us about wind chill either. That would have really made us mad. So he says, let's see how high this airplane could go.
Oh my gosh.
So we said, okay, Jay. So he gets up, and the engineer and I were on the flight deck. That's when it was warm. We still had oxygen on. We had to put oxygen on about 12,000 feet. And we always carried, if we were at it near, we always carried an oxygen bottle, that we stood around. So Jay says, hey, David, Pap, go back and check your guns. So I said to Pat, my engineer, I said, we fire mine too. He said, sure, I was fooling around my new radio equipment. So puts his walk-around model on, and he walks through the bomb bay, and he goes sooner. Within a half a minute, he said, "Get this effing airplane down. Foley is purple."
Oh.
Foley's the lower ball gunner. He's sitting in his lower ball waiting to be put down, you know, but we never, Jay didn't tell us to do that. And he was purple. He didn't have any oxygen. So my engineer took his oxygen off and put it on him. He would have been dead in 50 seconds. Yeah, and he saved his life. But when Pep said, "Get this effing fire," the pilot put that in a steep dive, and we were going over 500 miles an hour. And a B-24 is redlined. You're not supposed to go over 375, you know. So then he tries to pull it out. He and the co-pilot got their feet up on where all the instruments were and trying to pull the yokes back, you know, to try to get it out of the dive. No, it wouldn't come out of the dive. And all he was saying, because of his experience in the fight, he said, "Boys, clear your ears, clear your ears." If we would have been clearing our ears, our head would have exploded.
Yeah. You know?
So finally, it started to come out. We got in a heavier, denser air, but the way he got it out, I don't know if on an airplane, they have what they call trim pads. And those are used, if you're on autopilot and your plane is not flying exactly, you could trim the aileron so they would. So that's how he got it out. He started to pull it out from 21,000, and we pulled it out at 8,000. New plane was an absolute wreck. We came out, and the skin on the airplane was all wrinkled, you know.
Yeah.
Those guys said, "If you were flying one of those old airplanes," I said, "we would never see you. They were falling apart." It was lucky. It was a brand new airplane.
Wow.
Dave DiMicci, you are lucky that you are alive.
Yeah, I know. And then we used to visit Jay. I don't know, maybe ahead, but we used to visit. My wife and I used to visit Jay and his wife. They live in Mineral, California. And he was starting to lose it. Well, we thought he was old then. I mean, he was maybe 10 years older than us. But he must have been like in his 70s, and he had a congestive heart failure. And then we would go out. He'd take us around there's a big Mineral, California, around the mountains. And he worked for the government there doing something. And he says, "You know, Dave," he said, "you know, I'm losing it." I said, "What do you mean, Jay?" He says, "I don't remember how we got in that B-24. Well, we got in it. We just ducked underneath. The bomb bay door slid open. We just ducked under it and got on the catwalk and went to the flight deck or went to the waste area. So you remember how we got in that plane?" I said, "I don't know you, Jay, but I got in kicking and screaming."
Oh, Dave DiMicci, that's fun. Hey, we just have 2 minutes. Dave, okay. What would you like to say to young people in America today regarding the American flag, the American idea?
Well, I wrote a little article about the American flag, about the people, you know, football player making $1 million a year. I said, what we should do, this was near the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl, what they all have, these big boards up there, we have all the messages. They ought to have on a message saying that the people who are kneeling, this is meant for them. I said, in short, What you got to remember that when the flag was raised on Mount Suribachi by those six Marines and all the guys that were on stood up while the flag was being raised. Okay, I said, now the reason why all the Marines 6,000 couldn't stand because they were 6,000 teenagers who were killed protecting your right to either sit, stand, or kneel. Or stand and raise your hands in the fist. because we were protecting your constitutional right to do these things. And the last sentence I put down, won't you stand in their place?
Oh, that's great.
We've got to get a copy of that article, Dave.
Yeah, Dave DiMicci, thank you. This has been a fascinating interview. This is the Americhicks, Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. We've been talking with World War II veteran Dave DiMicci. And thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you,
now,
Dave.
What's going to happen to this thing?
We will tell you. We'll close the show and then we'll tell you.
So hold on. We'll be right back. And everybody else, thanks for listening. If you've got a World War II story, reach out to us at Americhicks.com. God bless you and God bless America.
Join us next time for the World War II Project and your hosts, the Americhicks, Molly Vogt and Kim Munson. Until then, keep saluting the greatest generation.